I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Opioid deaths in Pennsylvania and the rest of the country, frankly, represent the worst public health crisis in a generation, with some 130 people dying from overdose every day from prescription and illegal opioids. Our guest, Elise Schiller, has lived this crisis. Her daughter, Jonna, was a bright student, a promising athlete who also struggled with depression, anxiety, and anorexia. She was introduced to a synthetic opioid called Nubane while at her gym and soon was addicted to heroin. She was treated at different rehab facilities, released, and relapsed multiple times until her death from an overdose at a treatment center in Colorado in 2014. She was 33 years old. Elise Schiller's book, Even If Your Heart Would Listen, begins the day Jonna was born and traces how her daughter's addiction consumed her life and affected their relationship. She's honest about the rage, the frustration, the helplessness she felt being powerless to stop her daughter's drug use. Her book is also an indictment of the drug treatment system that she says didn't take into account the complexities of her daughter's addiction. Elise Schiller sat on Mayor Kenney's 2016 opioid task force. They came up with a series of recommendations to address Philadelphia's opioid crisis, including a supervised safe injection site. We will talk about all of this with our guest. And Elise Schiller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. You know, it was a tough book to read, I have to say. It must have been a tough book to write.
It was a tough book to write, of course. I lived through it, so it wasn't like it was news to me. But I did access all of Jonna's medical records, and of course I hadn't seen them. And I read a lot of her journals and letters and various things that I did not have access to, of course, until after her death. So in an odd way, I felt like my relationship with my daughter was growing, even though she was gone.
So you learned things about her from her own words, her own experience that perhaps gave some illumination into what she was going through?
Yes, I did. And, you know, helped me. You know, and heartbreakingly to understand the depth of, you know, her depression, her lack of self-esteem, her, as she put it herself, self-loathing.
Yeah, her self-loathing. Was this part of the mourning process for you then, to write this book? And I'm assuming as a parent who loses a child, that mourning will go on forever.
Yes. I don't think it's something that you get over. I know a lot of people who've lost children to many different things, and I don't think ever it gets better. And, you know, it gets better. It doesn't go away. Yes, part of the mourning process, but also what I felt I needed to do to get some information out in the world for other families who are still struggling with a loved one who might not have access to the most current information.
I do want to get to that, but let's talk about your daughter, Jonna. And you write really on the first page, first couple of sentences, you write, I wonder now if there was a little nugget inside you talking to your daughter, something that would burst into heartache later. I didn't know whom I was waiting for. And this is really hours before your daughter, Jonna, was born. But I underlined that because I felt like you were telling us something.
Well, there is a genetic risk factor for addiction, and there is a lot of addiction in my family.
Your dad was an alcoholic.
My dad died of alcoholism, yes, and I have a brother who's struggling. In addition to that, there is a lot of depression in my family, and so, you know, it's hard to say, but it's hard to prove. But I'm assuming I've always assumed that genetics played some role in her mental health issues and in her addiction.
I mean, as a parent or even as a newborn baby, you do not know what life has for you.
No, you certainly. I mean,
certainly an understatement there, but you just don't know.
But this is an important thing for all parents. When I speak at community events and so forth, you know, I'm frequently asked by parents of young and school-age children, what can we do? How can we prevent this? And one of the first things I say is, you know, if your child has any mental health issues, he or she is at higher risk. If there is a mental health diagnoses or addiction in your immediate family, this is a risk. If you have a child who suffered significant trauma, could be sexual abuse, it could be a parent incarcerated, you know, it could be having witnessed something very violent. Trauma in childhood is also a risk.
Yeah. You describe her toddler years going to, it sounds like it was Long Beach Island or so, somewhere in New Jersey.
Yes.
For the summer. And just, you said her toddler years were really the best years of her life. And there are pictures of her as a little girl enjoying the beach.
She was a very happy child. She was always a little bit quiet. That was a characteristic trait throughout her life. But, you know, she loved her siblings. She loved her life. She loved school from the very first day. There was no indication until later.
Well, as you say, she developed asthma as a young girl. It sounded like a pretty serious case of asthma.
Yes, actually, as a baby, really, as a child, a very young child. And that was an issue throughout her life. But she persevered, you know, using the drugs that were prescribed to her, and years and years and years of allergy shots, which really did make a difference.
Yeah.
She did need to avoid some environments. But, yeah, she was okay.
Not to belabor this, but she also in one of her diaries sort of wonders whether the attention that she got having asthma might have affected her behavior. And you even say the same thing when she became ill with anorexia and later with substance use disorder. I wondered about all the attention she had gotten, particularly from me, because of her illnesses.
Yes. And, when you're trying to unpack something like your child's death, you examine and re-examine everything. And so I definitely did wonder about that, and she wondered about it, and we talked about it at various times over time. It's a little hard to know that.
Yeah, yeah. She was very close to you and you to her, as you write.
Yes, we were very close, and she was, close to her siblings and to her father.
And a honor student?
An honor student.
A gifted swimmer?
Yes.
I mean, and again, looking at the picture, she looks like this sort of happy young person.
Yes. Things did start to emerge as a teenager. Mainly, I would say, an overreaction to not performing as well as she might want to, particularly with swimming. Two strong attachments to her boyfriends for her age. She did see a therapist for a time in high school, but then, went to college for the first year and things seemed well.
The little that I know about anorexia, there can be these issues of control and perfectionism and even self-denying. Did you see that in your daughter?
Yes. So when she did not perform the way that she wanted to in college, in that first year of college, she started to restrict her eating. And we learned, this is something that I never observed, but she talked about it, that as a child, she had some OCD behaviors that we completely missed.
Wow. Such as?
So there's a counting rituals with OCD and locking and unlocking, checking rituals that, she went through without our knowledge.
Yeah.
And frankly, in a busy household with four children, you You can miss things like that.
Absolutely. And if she's not going to tell you.
Right.
You're definitely going to miss things like that.
Right.
So with her anorexia, and I think for every parent, you know, you want your child to eat. And how frustrating, you even write about this, how frustrating it was to watch her, in a sense, not eat.
Yes. You know, when you first encounter the behavior, it's so counterintuitive that you're just, what is this? What does this mean? You know, it makes no sense. But, you know, it's not about the food. You know, it's a compulsive coping mechanism, not unlike, frankly, smoking, drug use, you know, many things to calm anxiety and to try to assert control when you don't feel in control. She really struggled. She missed 2 years of college. She got very good treatment for her anorexia from both a therapist and a treatment center where she spent 3 residential stays and outpatient programming and so forth. We were lucky there.
She writes, I realize that I hate big things like Thanksgiving. I hate how much how there is so much food and preparation and time. It stresses me out that my mom has to go to so many different stores and cook at 2 different houses, and everything is so messy. But why? Why does this affect me so much?
Right. She was quite self-aware and became more and more self-aware with more and more therapy. And what is the answer to that? We don't have an exact answer to that. But I do know, you know, that for a lot of her life, she was roiling with anxiety and went through periods of steep depression. And I think a lot of her behaviors were related to trying to get that under control, or at least to self-medicate or make herself feel better. But those behaviors themselves, those illnesses, let me say, the depression and anxiety, they were treated well when she was being treated for anorexia. Mm-hmm. After that, not so much. And certainly she never received integrated treatment for her substance use disorder and her mental health issues, which is very common, very, very common.
Let's take a short break and then we'll pick up on that. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with Elise Schiller. She's got a brand new book just came out called Even If Your Heart Would Listen, Losing My Daughter to Heroin. We're talking about her daughter, Jana. And Jana died in January 2014. She was just 33 years old. And our guest sat on Philadelphia Mayor Kenney's 2016 Opioid Task Force. And the book is really a searing description of what it was like for her daughter, also to understand the treatment system as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Elise Schiller. We're hearing one family's story of their battle with the opioid crisis and the recovery system. Elise Schiller's book is Even If Your Heart Would Listen. So your daughter was at the gym and literally got introduced to this opioid called Nubane.
Yes. It is a synthetic opioid that is generally used in medical settings. Honestly, I don't know who initially supplied. I know that she received the drug from her boyfriend, who was a bodybuilder in the gym. I don't know where he received it, although there were a group of guys, you know, bodybuilding together. And I know that one of them was the source. Mm-hmm. I found in her car bottles from a hospital setting or a manufacturing setting. And that's really all that I know.
Do you think, and based on what you know now about your daughter, that she was just almost pre-programmed to get addicted?
I think she had a lot of risk factors, yes. And I think that at that point, she was dependent on this boyfriend emotionally. Her beloved dog had just died, and so she was extremely upset. And I think, you know, he offered it, she took it. Yeah.
Do you know how soon, I guess, the opioids became heroin?
Oh, I do, yes. When she first entered treatment, which was Memorial Day weekend of 2012, she was only using Nubain. Right. And when she entered treatment again in September of 2012, she was using a number of opioids, but not heroin. That began in November of 2012. And I think it began because she did not have access to other drugs. She did not have an active prescription. She had had an injury and had a prescription for opioids, but that had run out. The injury was real. How much she needed the opioids, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Where'd she get her heroin? Boyfriends?
On the street. Boyfriends. I mean, primarily from or with a boyfriend. I found among her things a piece of paper with instructions of where to go to buy the heroin. So at some point, she obviously was going.
Someplace in Philadelphia.
Yes. Yes. Someplace in Kensington.
In Kensington.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, one thing I wanted to say was that this move from having access to not having access is one of the unintended consequences of clamping down on prescription, which I approve of. But we have to recognize that, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because what it has done has driven people who were addicted to pills into the street.
Your daughter was in a number of different facilities, and, you know, she would rehab and then get out, and in a matter of time she would relapse. But as you were telling me before going on the air, is that she checked herself in so that she knew she was in trouble.
Oh, yes.
And not everyone knows that about themselves.
That's part of it. And the other thing is that, you know, she had a very close relationship with us, and we were very supportive of her trying to get well. We did not, you know, shun her or, you know, quote unquote, tell her to hit bottom or any of those things. And the other thing is, she had a really good job and she had really good insurance.
So she had access to these facilities.
Yes, exactly. And ironically, almost all of them were recommended to her by her insurance company.
You do name names and you do criticize these various facilities, some of them here in the Philadelphia area, that they really, they wanted to focus on, I guess, the addiction part, but they did not see or didn't address the other components of her personality.
Well, that was one problem. I think it's an extremely common problem that care for co-occurring disorders, you know, whatever that may be, PTSD, right, depression, what have you, and substance use disorder are not well treated together in an integrated way. But, you know, I think the more immediate failure was that the facilities did not use medication-assisted treatment as their first line of defense or offense. And in fact, there was a time when she was in an outpatient program or entering a partial hospitalization program when her psychiatrist prescribed Suboxone for her, and the program would not let her enter if she was using Suboxone. So, you know, there was a strong bias against medication in many of these facilities. And this was after, long after, the FDA had approved three medications for use in treating opioid use disorder.
Do you think that's still true today? And we should say, you know, sadly, your daughter died in 2014, so we're talking about 5, 6, 7 years ago. Do you think things have changed since that time?
I think things are changing. I think that, ironically, the change has been led by public medicine, right? You can pay a whole lot of money in the treatment world and get lower quality, outdated treatment, and you can be on Medicaid and get better treatment. Yes, it's odd. But, you know, certainly our health commissioner in Philadelphia, Tom Farley, is a strong supporter because the evidence is overwhelming that people fare much better when they are using a medication than when they are not. We're talking about virtually no evidence base for abstinence treatment and a large evidence base for medication-assisted treatment.
Let me quote something from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. I Googled them this morning just to sort of find out where things stand today. And they write, effective medications exist to treat opioid use disorder. They talk about methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone. These medications could help many people recover from opioid use disorder, but they remain highly underutilized.
Yes. For a whole variety of reasons. I just read a study about how states that did not expand Medicaid use medications far less than states that did, because Medicaid is obviously one source to pay for these medications. But some of it is also linked to bias. So we're going to treat this the way that we treated alcoholism for decades, because that's what we're used to, and we don't want to try anything new.
Let me pick up on that. The idea of bias, that if you are a person with an addiction, you cannot be trusted to take medications, I mean, sort of lifelong medications that might help you through that. You've got a quizzical look on your face.
There may be some of that. I mean, I think it is more the association of substance use with a character defect or a moral failing that is part, frankly, of the AA baggage, and that a person must, you know, reform themselves in the 12-step manner, and that's the only way to be well. And frankly, that's just not true.
Yeah. Well, certainly it wasn't true for your daughter, right, Jana?
No, it wasn't true for my daughter. And, you know, as I said to you before we went on the air, Marty, I absolutely know people who have recovered in AA, almost all of them from alcohol, almost all of them with a mild or moderate alcoholism problem. My daughter had a severe opioid use disorder complicated by mental illness, and the 12 steps were not going to cure her. We're not going to put that into remission.
The idea it being, as you said, this sort of moral failing or perhaps a weakness on her part, that was not going to cure her.
No. I mean, in one treatment facility, she was given a list of 120 character defects, and the alternative to each one. And some of them were things like being too loud, and the alternative was being quiet and respectful. Now, if anybody is going to tell a 31-year-old or 32-year-old woman that she can help to cure her disease by being quiet, really?
And your daughter was quiet anyway.
She was quiet anyway. So that particular defect wasn't one of hers.
Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Elise Schiller, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about her brand new book. It's titled Even If Your Heart Would Listen, Losing My Daughter to Heroin. And her daughter, Jana, died in, she was at a treatment center in Colorado in 2014 from an overdose. She was just 33 years old. We are talking about Jana, but also talking about our healthcare system. And we'll be talking more about a supervised safe injection site, something that the mayor of Philadelphia is in support of. And our guest, Elise Schiller, sat on Mayor Kenney's 2016 Opioid Task Force. Let me read a couple of comments here. Can your guest speak to the for-profit treatment programs that only work in the short term? And I don't, you know, as your daughter was in a number of facilities, but did...
She was in two for-profit facilities. So, you know, there's far less transparency with the for-profit facilities than with the nonprofit facilities, although they don't necessarily function that differently. Mm-hmm. This is not – severe opioid use disorder is a lifelong, chronic, relapsing disease. This is not something that gets solved, you know, in detox for a week. And the whole notion is, you know, an addiction medicine doctor would just shake their head at that, you know. The hope is that the disease will go into remission through a combination of medication, therapy, and recovery supports, which might include something like NA, but probably right. In the case of somebody taking medication, not, because NA has a formalized stand against medication. So, but a recovery support group of some kind, it certainly is helpful. But many people, the majority of people with severe opioid use disorder have a co-occurring mental health issue. And if they've been using for a long time, they also have some, they may have criminal justice problems. They may have lost employment. So social support has to happen as well.
What was this like for you to watch your daughter and to deal with her struggles?
Well, first, I was completely blindsided. Completely.
You didn't know this was going on?
No idea. I mean, she was working full time. She was living in an apartment. She was supporting herself. I had no idea. You know, she struggled a lot with depression, so I was accustomed to asking her if she was particularly inaccessible or quiet. You know, are you okay? What's going on? She checked herself into a facility. She took a two-week vacation from work and checked herself into a facility and called me from there and let me know what was happening. You know, I have to say that I deeply regret now not doing more investigative work then. I took the advice of quote-unquote treatment professionals, and it was a mistake.
Yeah.
It was a mistake.
It's hard to know what to do. I mean, on the one hand, you're dealing with your daughter. She's an adult. On the outside, you know, looking probably better than on the inside.
Yes.
And how much do you intervene? How much do you try to control their lives? How much do you, you know, grill them every time you see them?
Right, of course. You know, I think we equate these treatment facilities with medical facilities and with medical care we might receive elsewhere. So, you know, if my daughter had been diagnosed, you know, with lupus, I certainly would have found out about lupus, but I would have trusted the medical professionals to guide us. That's what we're used to doing. And that was a mistake.
Yeah. I'm also trying, and as I was reading the book, but even talking to you now, I was thinking the little that I know of your daughter, Jana. I mean, here she was, an honor student, an incredible swimmer, a perfectionist in many ways, someone who valued sort of controlling her life. And here she is living her life, in a sense, out of control.
Yes.
And losing all the things that, you know, made her such a gifted person.
Yeah, that became extremely difficult for her.
I can only imagine. Yeah.
You know, as she watched, you know, her job disappear, she couldn't work. You know, her relationships basically evaporated. The only people that she had relationships with were her family and a few people she met in treatment and boyfriends who she would have been better off without.
Right.
Her world narrowed tremendously, and it was extremely difficult for her.
And what about her siblings, your other children?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, second.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is tough stuff.
That's one of the hardest things for me now, you know, is that my kids are really, they're doing well. They're doing really well. But I know that under the surface, this is always there. I know how much they worry about their own children. I have seven grandchildren. So, you know, there's constant concern and hovering and, you know, anxiety about them being okay. And I know that my kids share some of the feelings that I have about why didn't we do this? Why didn't we do that? What if we had done this? You know, it's a constant refrain.
We're going to take a short break, but let me just add, because I know this is tough for you, but I think it's a real public service that you have written this book and written it so honestly, and that you can talk so honestly about what this is like. I mean, it's just the most devastating thing to lose a child, especially to lose a child to heroin. Elise Schiller is our guest, and we're talking about her new book, Even If Your Heart Would Listen, subtitled Losing My Daughter to Heroin. Her daughter, Jonna, a bright student, a promising athlete, died of a heroin overdose of an overdose at a treatment center in 2014 at the age of 33. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Elise Schiller. She's a member of the advisory board of the Philadelphia Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disabilities Services, also served on the Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney's task force on the opioid epidemic, and she's the author of a new book we've been talking about called Even If Your Heart Would Listen. An email from Paul. Paul wonders whether our rehab programs just too short.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's a lot of debate about this. I think that if somebody is not on medication, and I'm talking here just about opioid use disorder, right? Not about other things, alcohol and stimulants. You know, the length of time is of little consequence. Jonna was in a treatment program for 4 months in one setting and went there from another treatment program. So she had been, you know, 5 months sober, and it made little difference because the quality of the treatment wasn't going to, you know, cure the problem. And her mental health issues were not addressed. What did it do? It allowed for us to visit Jonna once a week for 6 hours when she was not using and well, and to enjoy our daughter. That's what it did. It did not help her disease.
Did that feel like something at the time? I mean, to be able to be with her knowing that she wasn't using?
Marty, I would have, you know, figured out some way to pay them forever if I could have just seen my daughter once a week. But, you know, there are better ways. There is a mountain of evidence about what works and what does not work. So, you know, we as a community of citizens need to advocate for better treatment.
And better treatment from your perspective certainly applied to your daughter, but probably to a lot of other people, is to think of the kind of medications that can deal with these multifactorial issues for a person.
Yes. For some p- period of time, people advocated for medication-assisted treatment, meaning the medication came sometimes after, mm-hmm. whereas now a lot of people are advocating for medication-first treatment. So the very first thing that you do is stabilize somebody on medication so that the cycle of craving and use, withdrawal, craving, use, withdrawal, is broken and people can actually benefit from therapy, addiction counseling, support groups, social service supports, and so forth. So many people have described what that cycle does and how it's virtually impossible to concentrate on anything else. And throughout Jonna's journals and her notes, she references this.
That she just, because she was dealing with withdrawal, she really couldn't attend to all the other things that were being offered.
She was in treatment, as I said, in one stretch for 5 months. And in month four and in month five, you know, she's still writing on a daily basis about the level of her anxiety and depression, about the craving for something, heroin presumably, or some other opioid that would dull those feelings. Yeah, the length of time only matters depending upon the content of the treatment.
A comment from Joanne: I'm sorry for your guest loss, but I'm 35 years clean and sober. I work with people in addiction, and the claim that Medicare makes things easier isn't true in my experience. There are too few beds allocated to people with Medicaid, which is for low-income people, and it makes it harder in some cases to get people into treatment. And that is also true, is it not?
Oh, yes. She's not wrong. I mean, it's the whole delivery system is disjointed, full of barriers, but the fact remains that as of now, I don't believe our city is contracting with treatment providers who will not provide medication. Mm-hmm. So at least we know that people who are being referred to a treatment provider will get that. Yes, everything else that this person says is true. We have an enormous amount of work to do. Just an example would be somebody is brought to the emergency room, they're revived, and they walk out the door without anything.
Right.
And you know they're going to go immediately back. So we have to make sure that we can have a continuum of care.
Let me play. This is I do want to play a clip, but let me first read a Facebook comment from Jim, who says, it's not good for a non-AA person to criticize AA practices publicly. It can cost more lives. Let the help seekers decide on their own. I'm sure you've heard that before.
Yes, I have to disagree with that. I think that we need to call AA and NA what they are, recovery supports. I said before that I think that they have helped people, but they are not treatment.
And there's a difference between treatment and support.
Well, imagine if you had another chronic disease and, let's say, diabetes. Would you accept a treatment that said, well, you know, just don't take your insulin. Don't take the medication. Go to the group and try to get support for controlling your diet and your exercise and your weight. Yeah, do that. Absolutely do that. But don't stop taking your insulin.
Let me play a clip, and this is U.S. Attorney William McSwain. Back in February, he sued Safe House. This is a nonprofit working to open a supervised injection site in Philadelphia. I should say that our guest is a member of Friends of Safe House, providing support and doing some fundraising, and this is a controversial issue. And this is McSwain. He has been vocal in his opposition to this proposed supervised injection site, which does have the support of Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney. And let's give it a listen.
We have a responsibility, obviously, to protect the rule of law in this district. Opening an injection site would make the crisis worse. Normalizing drug use is not the answer to combating the opioid epidemic.
So what do you say in response to the U.S. attorney?
Oh, I can say a lot of things. I mean, first of all, normalizing drug use may be one of the solutions, in the sense that this facility will be set up to keep people alive and help them access treatment. It is not a factory that somebody is paying $5,000 to use as a rave site. It is not an abandoned house in the city that the landlord is collecting $5 from each person who wants to use it to do drugs in. That is not what this is. There are medical personnel on site. They reverse overdoses. They provide sterile syringes. They provide wound care. They encourage people to go to treatment and are able to make the referrals. There are about 120 of these sites throughout Canada and Europe. There's a lot of evidence of their efficacy. They are not the only solution to this problem. Mm-hmm. They are one solution. It's an extremely complex problem. Many, many things have to be done, and this is one.
And if this gets the green light and goes ahead, again, this would be funded by, not by the government, by private individuals.
Yes.
And would be the first in the country, as I understand it.
Yes. There are some other municipalities that are trying as well. But I, as far as I know, you know, this is the only place where a federal law enforcement person has tried to stop it. And so the rest of the country is kind of waiting to see how this plays out.
Should drugs, all drugs, be decriminalized?
I think so. I have to qualify that. Does that mean that I think people should, you know, be able to buy heroin in a dispensary? No, absolutely not. Does it mean that I think, you know, big cartels shouldn't be taken down? No, they should be. But severe opioid use, severe any use, methamphetamine, cocaine, is not a crime. It's a disease. And it needs to be treated that way, not as a crime. We have spent an enormous amount of money, an enormous amount of resources treating this as a crime, and it's not solved a problem. It's created more problems. So, yes, I do think we should decriminalize use.
We're dealing with a public health crisis. I mean, the worst in a generation, as most people seem to agree.
Dr. Farley, our health commissioner, says that this is the worst public health crisis since the 1918 flu pandemic in terms of the numbers of dead.
In Philadelphia, then? Or
in the country.
In the country.
In the country, yes. We have not... You know, when you look at the numbers, it's staggering, 70,000 people in a year.
Right.
I mean, that's more than all the Americans who died in Vietnam, plus. It's an enormous amount of death. And it, I can tell you, it leaves behind a lot of collateral damage.
Indeed. It's been called, in many ways, deaths of despair. Do you see it that way?
Yes, to some degree. There's a wonderful book called Dope Sick by a writer, Beth Macy, that describes really well the beginnings of the prescription opioid epidemic in Appalachia as a response partly to poverty, loss of jobs, loss of hope, coupled by extremely aggressive policies by pharma, you know.
I mean, literally, it sounds like targeting.
Oh yes,
towns.
Absolutely. And again, when the prescriptions tightened, when we started to tighten the ability to prescribe, the heroin just came down the highway to those towns, and you know, so. The fault at the beginning, yes, we can look at pharma, but there's a chain of events that have followed. And we have a lot of work to do on many fronts.
because I think you described so aptly. And I remember doing shows about withholding pain medication. This was years ago. And then the introduction, no, we can control, we can mitigate some of the discomfort that comes from pain. But then there's the overprescription. And then we've got the addiction to prescription opioids. And then when they're withdrawn, then you've got heroin to take its place.
Exactly. I have a cousin who had a fall and separated his muscle from his bone or something.
Ouch.
Yeah. He was in the hospital for a couple of days because there was also some infection. He left with 90 pills, and he used four. The rest sat in his medicine cabinet. Very dangerous because one of his children has a substance use issue. So, this is repeated all over the place. The number of prescriptions is huge.
Huge. Let me get Noah from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And, Noah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks
there
for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a clinical social worker. I was working out of Philadelphia, and I also happen to personally have a history of severe opioid use disorder, and I just wanted to comment that I am strongly in support of what your guest is advocating. Myself, I've actually been on a low dose of Suboxone for nearly 10 years now, actually, about 2 milligrams a day, and the harm reduction approach to opioid use disorder just makes so much more sense than the abstinence-only model if we really want to see people stop dying. The idea that an abstinence-only approach to treating a disease like opioid use disorder will be effective compared to medication-assisted treatment, both acutely and chronically, like in my case, and harm reduction. I feel strongly that your guest is absolutely right across the board.
Well, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Elise a chance to respond.
So, Noah, I'm very appreciative that you used the term harm reduction. I should have used that term when I was talking about the safe injection site. It's pretty self-evident, right? Let's stop harm.
Absolutely.
Let's keep people alive. You know, let's give them another shot at recovery. My daughter died alone. As far as we are aware, she purchased the heroin at an NA meeting that the treatment center sent her to from a person at that meeting.
Wow.
That's not that uncommon. But every day, do I wish that my daughter had her overdose reversed and had another chance at treatment and another chance to get well? Absolutely.
Well, we have to end our conversation there. Elise Schiller, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, and thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.
You're very welcome. The book is called If Your Heart Would Listen, Losing My Daughter to Heroin. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. My thanks to Tracy Matisak for filling in for me last week. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.